The Immortal Game, episode number 5. The Immortal Game is a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year and is available in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com. Chapter 9, Worf Tour. I needed a drink, badly. I met up with one in the bar of the Hotel San Remo on Mason Street. It was a quaint Victorian building with no more than 30 rooms. Outside, they were setting up for a shot from the new TV cop show that was being filmed in San Francisco, with lights, reflectors, heavy cables, and prop and makeup people crowding the sidewalk in front. Inside, I had the place to myself. I ordered a bourbon and soda. The bartender was a tall Indian with a high forehead, receding silver and iron-colored hair, a thick black mustache, and wire-rimmed glasses. He wanted to talk, and women were what he wanted to talk about. "They take your energy," he said in a sing-song voice. "They take your life energy by tempting you with sex. A man derives his strength from the seed in his loins, and a woman steals it when she copulates with him." I wanted to hear this bit of Eastern mumbo-jumbo about as much as I wanted to hear Ode to a Nightingale read by the Elks Lodge Women's Auxiliary. "Interesting theory," I said. "I feel the same way about mucus. Never blow my nose." The bartender gave me a queer look and walked down to the other end of the bar. A sudden crisis involving dirty beer glasses, apparently. I nursed my bourbon and fired up a cigarette and looked forward to the time my pulse would come down to the low 90s. I never get used to being shot at, no matter how many times it happens. Minutes crept by like ice floes on the Volga, and presently a rangy-looking guy in jeans and an Oakland Raiders sweatshirt came in. He was wearing the ubiquitous baseball cap turned backwards, with a pair of mirrored sunglasses. He gave me a brief glance and then took a seat at the other end of the bar. I figured him for a member of the TV crew. After my cigarette was long gone and I'd chewed all the ice at the bottom of my glass, I flagged the bartender and settled my tab. I had decided to go back to the power station and pull a little stakeout duty. When you stir up an anthill with a stick, the ants eventually come back to put things right. I was hoping Terry McCullough would be in their number. I threaded my way through the TV paraphernalia in front of the hotel and went up Mason Street. As I turned on Chestnut, I looked back and caught sight of the guy in the Raider sweatshirt from the bar. Appearing to take notice of my glance, he bent down in front of a newspaper machine and went through the motions of buying a paper. That didn't mean he had to be following me, but if he was, he surely did stink. I continued east on Chestnut, past the power station, without looking behind me. 3 blocks up at Grant, I went into the neighborhood branch of the public library, strolled past the front desk, and found a place to lurk in the stacks where I could see the front door. 5 minutes later, the guy in the sweatshirt came breezing in without his paper. He stopped at the front desk to ask something, had the librarian shake her head no in response, and then cautiously glanced around the room. Not seeing me, he sat down in a chair along the back wall near the magazine racks. He made a show of reading one, but kept looking out from behind it like a squirrel afraid of losing its nut. I crept along behind the stacks, then stepped out and walked briskly across the room to where he was sitting. Snagging the pole that held the New York Times as I went, I slammed it across the arms of his chair when I reached him. "What the hell?" was his response. "You should give up on highlights and get something you can really sink your teeth into," I said. He was still wearing his mirrored sunglasses. Up close, his skin had a greasy pallor, and his breath smelled like the fumes from a rendering plant. "Go ahead," he said. "Be funny. Just do it somewheres I'm not." That would be easier if you weren't stuck to me like so much discarded chewing gum. He grabbed the newspaper pole and jerked it out of my hands. "No need to talk sense on my account. You followed me here from the hotel bar." "No, I didn't. I found it on my own. I go around the city every day without any help from you. You'd be amazed." I felt the slightest twinge of doubt. You're telling me you just happened to go into the bar for a drink at the same time I did, and then you just happened to go into the library right afterward. I wasn't telling you anything, strictly speaking, but if you have to be told, I came here to get last week's ball scores since the paper didn't have them. He pointed at the football magazine he'd been reading. We were beginning to attract attention. The old guy in the chair next to us was giving us dirty looks, and the librarian had come out from behind the desk. The sweatshirt guy noticed me looking around and gave me an oily grin. Maybe you should ask the nice librarian lady to help you find a book. You could look under D for delusional. Now buzz off. Take the air. Go burp your Tupperware, Reardon. His face dropped as he said my name. We stared at one another for a long moment, and suddenly he lunged forward with a newspaper pole, impaling me in the stomach. The sharp thrust knocked the wind out of me, and he pressed his advantage by charging out of the chair, one arm wrapped around the pole like a jousting knight, the other bending to elbow me in the jaw. I flew ass over tea kettle onto the floor. He was already sprinting out the door by the time I rolled upright. "Good Lord, what was that about?" said the librarian, who had come up beside me. I got to my feet and rubbed my jaw. 2 solid shots in one day. If this kept up, I would have to send it back to the factory, I said. He was upset because I was reading over his shoulder, and started after him. I pushed through the double doors of the library, then stopped short to look around. I spotted him half a block down Chestnut, going back towards the power station. He had slowed to a brisk walk, but when he looked back and saw me, he started running again. I went after him full speed. I'm no marathoner, but when it comes to a sprint, I can cover the ground pretty quickly. By the time he reached Stockton, I was only 50 yards away. In the next block to Powell, I closed the gap further, and I could easily make out the Raiders slogan on his sweatshirt. He twisted around to look at me, and his glasses flew off as he snapped his head to the front, frightened by my proximity. I stomped the lenses into the sidewalk. Approaching Mason, he was just out of my grasp, but I was starting to wheeze like a busted accordion. A clump of cars and TB people from the shoot at the Hotel San Remo were crowding the intersection, a large black limo in the middle of it. The guy in the sweatshirt ran through the crowd, jostling and shoving people as he went. I did the same. Right as we came up to the limo, the back door opened and out stepped a guy in an expensive suit and meticulously coiffed hair. It was Dan Hansen, star of the TV cop show. I watched as the sweatshirt guy grabbed hold of Hansen and flung him directly into my path. I hit Hansen square in the shoulders, taking him down for a 10-yard loss. As we bounced off the side of the limo and rolled into the street, one part of my brain was thinking it was ridiculous to dress a guy playing a cop in a suit like that, and the other was hoping I didn't slam my jaw into something new. We rolled into the gutter, and while Hansen was too dazed to say anything, his handlers were hopping mad. With a woman in a black beret and short blonde hair screaming obscenities in my face, I stepped up from the wreckage and helped pull the actor to his feet and dust him off. His stiffly moosed hair was standing up on end like a rooster's comb, and his cheek was abraded from the asphalt. I mumbled something about being sorry, gave Hansen a little shot in the arm, and said, "Now you're looking like a real cop." The guy in the sweatshirt was nowhere to be found along Mason. However, 2 blocks up on Chestnut, I saw someone who looked like him turn right at the intersection and walk out of view. I double-timed it up Chestnut, past rows of colorfully painted condominiums, past a construction site with a tall crane where more were being built, until I came to a 3-way intersection. Here, Chestnut and Taylor lay perpendicular to one another, and Columbus cuts through on a slant. Across the street on Columbus, I could see Bimbo's 365 Club. I didn't think it was a coincidence the power station was in walking distance from the place where the threatening phone calls to Bishop and me were made. There was nothing doing on Columbus, so I looked down Taylor in the direction the sweatshirt guy had turned. The Powell and Mason cable car terminated a short ways up at Bay, and there was a crowd of people in a semicircle behind the rail at the turnaround. I caught sight of the back of my man's head, the bill of his baseball cap bobbing up and down as he walked briskly through the waiting tourists. Holding tight to the near side of the street, I went after him as fast as I could without drawing attention to myself. My chest was still heaving and I was soaked with sweat, and I didn't want to spook him into another foot race. As I approached the turnaround, I went past a series of graffitied, bunker-like buildings that comprised the Bay Street public housing complex. It is one of the ironies of city planning in San Francisco that tourists fresh off the cable car get dumped right into the middle of the projects. I threaded my way around the back of the crowd and popped out by the stoplight at the intersection of Bay and Taylor. I could see the guy in the sweatshirt across the street, going down Taylor into the heart of Fisherman's Wharf. I was just concluding he thought I was out of the picture when he looked back and spotted me standing at the intersection. He broke into a run. I dove across the intersection against the light, dodging cars and pedicabs carrying tourists. I pounded down Taylor across North Point, then Beach, then Jefferson, and finally came panting to a stop underneath a gigantic ship's wheel with a picture of a crab in the middle. It had been donated by the big restaurant owners in the area, was tacky as hell, and had become the unofficial symbol of the wharf thanks to prominent display on the opening credits of yet another TV cop show from the 1970s. I leaned against the crab wheel, completely out of breath, with no sign of the sweatshirt guy anywhere. I had lost sight of him about a block back, and now was surrounded by large schools of tourists moving up and down the wharf like so many migrating tuna. Some were heading west towards the twin temptations of the Cannery and Ghirardelli Square. Some were going east towards Pier 39, the citadel of crass commercialism in the area. And still others were feeding among the rows of restaurants ahead of me. Included among these were the famous Fisherman's Grotto and Aliotto's, where you could get crab cocktail and sourdough bread for $9.95 from the takeaway stands out front. This entitled you to brag to your friends back home that you'd eaten the quintessential San Francisco meal, but you probably didn't mention that the bread was baked in Oakland and the crab flown in from Alaska. A musical group from Chile dressed in native costume and packing pipes and drums was making noise in the pave area in front of the restaurants. I drifted over to join the crush of people watching them, burrowing between a fat lady in a pink running suit and a tall kid holding a skateboard. I stood two songs worth of the repertoire, hunkering low, looking up and down the wharf before I spotted the guy in the sweatshirt. He was directly across from me in the audience, trying his damnedest to blend in too. I broke off from the crowd and looped around behind him, screening myself from view with the aid of several strategically placed hot dog and pretzel stands. When I was directly in back of him, I reached across a pair of nuns in habit and grabbed him by the neck of his sweatshirt. He jumped like a hooked marlin. I gave a sharp yank, causing him to topple backward and land in a sprawl on the asphalt. The nuns gasped. While he thrashed and twitched and clutched at his throat where the sweatshirt was cutting into him, I dragged him along the ground to a concrete bench near the food stands. I leaned down to take two handfuls of his sweatshirt and jerked him onto the bench beside me. His baseball cap was twisted sideways, his face was flushed, and he was breathing like an asthmatic at the Cherry Blossom Festival. I said, "First off, unless you're playing catcher for the Giants this year, and I haven't seen your ugly pan on my bubblegum cards, wear your freaking cap the other way around." I pulled the bill of his cap roughly around to the front. "Second, I'll have an answer now to the question of why you were following me, and exactly how you know my name." The sweatshirt guy licked his lips and swallowed. "You haven't got a thing on me. You aren't the cops, and you can't do anything here to make me talk." He was right. I wasn't the sort to break fingers, and I didn't have a gun I could wave in his face. He watched me thinking these things, and that oily grin from the library crept onto his face. "Give it up, Reardon. You're whipped. As much as I've enjoyed rubbing your nose in it, it's time we went our separate ways." Desperate times call for desperate measures. I wasn't going to chase him all over North Beach with nothing to show. I reached across his torso and took hold of a belt loop on the far side of his body. In one movement, I stood up and yanked him like it was starting a lawnmower. It was the last thing he expected. He spun over on the bench, landed on his stomach, and tried to bite the nearest armrest. He seemed to lose consciousness. I reached down to extract his wallet and moved a few steps away to examine my prize. His name was Todd Nagel, and he was a member of a construction union. He was 32 years old, and he lived in Daly City, a suburb just south of San Francisco. He had a Sears charge card, a BART ticket, not much cash, and a whole bunch of nudie pictures. I started flipping through them looking for familiar faces, or other body parts, but I let myself get too absorbed in my task. When I glanced up to see how Mr. Nagel was doing on the bench, I found he wasn't there. He was standing right next to me with a squeezed bottle of mustard from the hot dog cart. He fired a stream of it directly into my eyes. I suddenly had a very good idea where the Germans got the name for mustard gas in World War I. My eyes teared over immediately, and I felt the wallet slapped from my hands. I pulled out my shirt tail and hunched over it, trying to wipe the mustard out of my eyes. My left eye was out of commission, but I could just squint out of my right. Through it, I saw Nagel ahead of me, running in the direction of the bay. I stumbled after him, but kept bumping into people or pulling up short to wipe my tears. At the edge of the wharf, I paused to scan the area through a mustardy haze. There was a pier for the submarine Pan Panito, guided tours for $5, a set of coin-operated telescopes for looking at Alcatraz and Angel Islands, and the pier for the Red and White Fleet, which ran ferries to Tiburon and Sausalito. Nagel was charging up the walkway to one of the ferries. "Final boarding call at gate number 2 for the Sausalito ferry," came an announcement. I lurched towards the walkway, but without a ticket was stopped at the gate by the attendant. I was in no condition to crash through. I turned and fought my way up the line to the ticket window, but by the time I purchased one, the boat had left the pier. I stood at the edge of the wharf next to the telescopes, elbowed by little boys climbing the railing and swiveling the scopes without any quarters to spend, mustered all up and down my shirt, tears still streaming from my eyes, and watched as the boat powered out into the bay. Nagel stood at the stern of the ferry and waved goodbye. Although I didn't know exactly what it meant, the only thing that made me feel the slightest bit better was the naked picture of Jody I had seen in his wallet. Chapter 10. In the Key of G. I managed the trip home without reenacting any more highlights from Three Stooges films. It was 6:20. I dumped a can of spaghetti into a pot, mixed in a can of pinto beans, threw in a dash of hot sauce, heated the mixture until it burped like molten lava, then ladled the whole mess onto 3 slices of sourdough toast. I accompanied the meal with 2 cans of beer and a classic 1937 Roy Eldridge Vocalon reissue. I showered, changed, and killed the rest of the time before leaving for my 9:30 gig by pressing ice packs to the side of my face. It had swollen up like I was packing a 3-plug chaw. I was subbing that night for the bass player of a jazz quartet called Distant Opposition. Their regular bassist, Leo Rand, was down in L.A. doing some studio work on a breakfast cereal jingle. Most of the gigs I got were like that. One-night stands where I subbed for a bassist in a regular group, or played in a pickup ensemble put together to support a big name who was in town for one show. Distant Opposition played classic jazz without a lot of electric amplification. That meant I was taking my wife to the show, wife being the slang term among jazz musicians for a string bass. I lugged the bass down the street and loaded it into the Galaxy 500, in a specially designed rack I had installed in place of the back seat. I had to crank the starter 4 or 5 times before the car turned over. When it did, I pointed it down high in the direction of a south-of-market dive called In the Key of G. You can count on 2 hands the number of clubs in San Francisco that regularly feature jazz. In the Key of G was among the heartiest. What it lacked in atmosphere, acoustics, seating capacity, and interior illumination, it made up in a dedicated cadre of patrons, a commitment to quality acts, and a peerless bartender named Slim. I parked my car in 8th, next to the converted brick warehouse that was home to the club, and navigated my base down the dingy concrete steps of the entrance on Minna. A stifling amalgamation of cigarette smoke, rowdy bar talk, clinking glasses, and the smell of beer assailed me as I stepped through the doors of the basement room. The space was long and narrow, with a stage wedged in the back against a bare brick wall. Along the right was a chromium metal bar that looked like an examining table at the morgue. A set of bar stools with more duct tape than upholstery went with it, and a random collection of cocktail tables, some round, some square, some wood, some metal, all of them wobbly, was arranged in front of the stage. The crowd was just as eclectic. There were the cool South of Market types, the young women in black synthetic clothing with clunky shoes and ridiculous purses like miniature backpacks, and the guys in jeans with heavy leather boots, wide leather belts, and tight short-sleeved shirts. Hair dyed improbable shades of red, blonde, or purple was common among both sexes, as were tattoos and piercings of all kinds in every conceivable place. One woman seated at the bar had enough loops in her ear to hang a shower curtain. Standing shoulder to shoulder with these were the well-heeled yuppies who worked in the financial district downtown. Men dressed in Italian suits with the latest designer tie selected by their wives talked about IPOs, NASDAQ, venture capital, and the internet, all while making double-arm gestures that could be used to wave in a jet. Leaving the crowd were a handful of inner-city blacks who showed up to support Cornelius Crawford, Distant Opposition's outstanding alto sax player, a hometown hero who was on a trajectory for greater glory. There were even a few ordinary schmoes who came to get out of the house, have a drink, and hear some live jazz. Using my bass as a shield, I waded through the crowd until I came abreast of the bar. Slim was standing behind it, straining a bright pink concoction from a shaker into a glass. He was wearing his usual white shirt and red bow tie. He was balding, bony, and had an Adam's apple so prominent it waggled his tie when he swallowed. "Got your pink lady right here, August," he boomed. "Straight up, just like you like it." "Sorry, I only drink those when I play my concertina and yodel. I don't think the guys would go for that tonight." "Suit yourself." I hauled the bass the rest of the way up to the stage and set it down carefully on its side. The other musicians were already there getting set up. I shook hands all around and thanked Saul Hodges, the bandleader and drummer, for giving me the gig. I pulled out a square of carpet I carry around to anchor the bass on slick surfaces and plopped it down and back, between the piano and the drum kit. Then I took the bass out of its zipper bag and wiped off the strings with a rag. As I began tuning up, I heard all the usual grousing that goes with musicians on club dates. Cornelius Crawford wasn't happy with the reed in his mouthpiece. At first it was too dry, then too wet. Tristan Sinclair, the pianist, didn't like the house piano for the same reason all pianists hate house pianos. It was out of tune. Hodges was having trouble squeezing his ride cymbal in next to me, and the tendonitis in his elbow was acting up. Nick Dundee, the trumpeter, said the valve action on his horn wasn't smooth enough and was busy dousing the valves with oil. Hodges passed around a rumpled cocktail napkin where he'd written the set list. I didn't pay much attention to anything but the first tune because I knew he would call each one before we started, and he never stuck to the list anyway. The first tune was a bouncy, up-tempo standard by Charlie Shavers called Undecided. When we were ready to roll, Hodges gave Slim the high sign, and Slim flicked on a mic he kept behind the bar. "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to In the Key of G. Tonight we are featuring the best in classic jazz from a group of young lions who know how to shake it up and pour it. Please give a big round of applause to Saul Hodges Quintet, Distant Opposition, featuring Cornelius Crawford on alto sax." The applause started in the middle of Slim's intro and crested when he got to Crawford's name. A number of people in the audience shouted, "Crawdad, Crawdad." The house lights went down and spots came on. Looking back into a smoky tunnel of light with my heart pounding and my fingers slick and slippery on the strings, I felt a rush of excitement like I was standing on top of a high dive. Hodges counted off a tempo and cued Sinclair, who played an introduction on the piano. At the end of four bars, the rest of us dove in. Crawford and Dundee led us through a chorus of the melody in unison, four sections of eight bars, the third being the bridge. Things were a little ragged at the start, and Dundee blew one outright clam. Crawford came in smoothly after the melody and played two choruses of a jubilant solo. He got a big round of applause when he stepped back, and Sinclair followed him with two more choruses on the piano. Dundee came next and more than made up for the clam, straightening his back like a limbo dancer, horn jabbing at the ceiling as he hit the high, hard ones. He also earned a solid round of applause. The bass and drum don't always solo, but when I looked over to Hodges near the end of Dundee's, he yelled, "Trade fours," which meant that he and I were to alternate with four bars each. I kicked it off and resisted the temptation to play upstairs, since I knew Hodges was a traditionalist and liked the bass to sound like one with deep, fundamental notes. When I passed it to Hodges, he showed off some of the excellent brushwork he'd made his name with, and then it was right back to me. We went back and forth like that until it was time to go back to the melody, or so I thought. I'd forgotten that Shaver's arrangement had a shout chorus at the end. I fluffed several notes until I dropped the melody and picked up with the shout. Fortunately, the horns were growing great guns by then, and the only one who noticed was Hodges, who gave me a dirty look. We closed with a rousing turnout and got a nice ovation from the crowd. More cries of "Crawdad" rose above the applause, but surprisingly, someone also called my name. I looked down into the audience and found Jody sitting by herself at a table in the third row. She had traded her neoprene skirt for a simple black leotard and jeans, but she still had enough sex appeal to make a speech therapist talk in tongues. She waved enthusiastically when she caught my eye, and I waved back. Dundee saw the exchange and twisted around to give me a good look of him simulating fellatio with his trumpet. "That's some nice skank you got there, Reardon," he said, grinning like a baboon. "Why don't you fix me up with that at the break?" "Sorry, Dundee. She doesn't like guys who blow their own horn." "Ha! Can it," said Hodges harshly, then called out, "Blue Monk." Blue Monk was a 12-bar blues number by Thelonious Monk. Hodges didn't care for most of Monk's compositions because he regarded them as self-indulgent and too dissonant-sounding. In fact, he had once said the sheet music for Monk's tunes looked like flies had walked across the paper. Blue Monk was different, though. It was an approachable, straight-ahead blues number. Dundee scrambled to get the mute on his horn, and then Hodges called out the slower blues tempo. Piano, bass, and drums came in together and laid down the theme immediately. For me, the melody to Blue Monk had always evoked the image of a drunk stumbling home late at night. The front line joined us after the bridge, Dundee's muted horn dominating and giving a real blue mood to the piece. At the end of the chorus, Hodges went into a soft drum press and yelled for me to walk it. I played a fluid, constant progression that provided a sort of rhythmic propulsion for the music. Dundee took the first solo and blew directly at Jody. I had to admit that he sounded great, and I didn't get any argument from the audience. Dundee looked back at me when he was finished and stroked his goatee with a wise-ass expression, as if to say, "Beat that." Crawford took the next chorus, and if anything, played better than Dundee. Sinclair followed with a credible solo on piano, but probably could have used more left hand, which was a complaint I'd heard about him before. Hodges called for me next, and whether because I felt I was competing with Dundee for Jody's attention, or was inspired by the image of the drunk, I gave one of my better solos, a moody, resonant, shambling kind of thing. It provoked table pounding and shouts of, "Oh yeah," from the audience. Dundee looked back to stick his tongue out, and I responded by moving the bass up a few inches. We stepped cleanly back into the head of the melody then, with all the players on board. Crawford came to the front and we followed his lead on an improvised ending that sounded rehearsed. It was nicely done. We played 5 more tunes in the set, closing with Sunny Sits, Loose Walk. The house lights went up, and after I wiped down the bass and laid it carefully on the stage, I went over to join Jody. Dundee was already at the table leering over her, but I said, "Amscray, chumperoo," and elbowed him off to the side. "He's cute," said Jody after I sat down. "What's his name?" "Joseph Mengele. We call him the Doc." "Nice try, August. I know about Ostowich, and that's not something you should be joking about." "I'm sorry. You're right. His name is Nick Dundee. But pay him no mind, because there's a strong tradition in jazz that the bass player gets all the women." "Well, I'm not exactly what you would call a traditional girl. What happened to your face?" "Funny you should ask," I said, and signaled the waitress for a round of drinks. "A couple of friends of yours entertained themselves today by taking swipes at it." I told her about my encounter at the power station and the chase with the guy in the sweatshirt, without mentioning the photo in his wallet. "So what's the story with this Chuck character?" She sipped from her drink and then shrugged. "There's not much to tell. He works in security, just as you were told. His last name is Haystrup, and he played pro ball in Pittsburgh for several years. That's all I know about him, except he's a real hard ass. He's not somebody you want to tangle with, August." "I've already ascertained that through independent research. But what's his connection to Terry McCullough? Why did he stick his beak into it?" "I don't know that he has any special connection to Terry, except that he works at the power station. Frankly, it doesn't surprise me that he was alerted when he went there. From what you told me, it doesn't sound like you came across as a very credible client. You would have done better to present the card I gave you and simply ask to talk to Terry." "Yeah, maybe. What about this other joker, Nagel? What do you know about him?" "Nothing. Why would I?" "No particular reason," I said, "except maybe the picture he had of you sitting on the beach playing the ukulele in your birthday suit." Jody reddened slightly. "Oh, that one. It's from the spread in Pussyfoot I did a couple of years ago. Anybody with $5.95 can get a copy." "So you're saying it's just a coincidence that Nagel had one too?" "Yep, an embarrassing coincidence, but still a coincidence." "Okay, one last question. Shoot, what's it going to take to get you to come up on stage and join us for a tune in that same getup?" Jody reached across the table to tweak my nose. "A lot more than $5.95. A lot more. Well, thanks for coming. It was great to have the support and make Nick Dundee jealous as hell." Jody left before the second act. The band was smoother and looser, both because we were warmed up and because we'd all had a drink or two or three during the break. We did a half dozen more tunes and closed with Perdido from the Ellington Songbook. I hung around for a time to shoot the breeze, but got bored with it after Slim closed the bar and Saul Hodges started to tell the hoary old story about the time Buddy Rich cursed out his band at the top of his lungs in the middle of a gig. I said my goodbyes and carried my bass up the stairs to the street. Outside there was a dense fog, and the air felt cold and damp on my face after the close atmosphere of the club.
You have been listening to The Immortal Game, a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year. You can find it in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com.